When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today we're going to be having a little bit of amphibian talk.
That's right. We're going to be chatting with Mark Bandica, the executive director of the Amphibian Foundation. The Amphibian Foundation is an Atlanta-area-based nonprofit organization dedicated to connecting individuals, communities, and organizations in order to create and implement lasting solutions to the global amphibian extinction crisis. So it was just a great opportunity for us to reach out to a local expert in their field to discuss the wonderful world of amphibians, especially salamanders.
Right. So we talk frogs, tadpoles, especially salamanders, some death-defying winter weather adventures. I think we talk some Wolverine toward the end.
Yeah, there will be cannibal morphs. So if you're getting all geared up for Halloween, don't worry. There will be some Halloween-worthy content in this episode. And you'll just learn a great deal about amphibian biology. Just a little more info here before we get rolling. If you want to check out more about the Amphibian Foundation, you can go to amphibianfoundation.org. You can also follow them on Twitter. Their handle is amphibianfound. On Instagram, it's amphibianfoundation, and it's amphibianfound on Facebook as well. And Mark is also on Twitter himself. You can follow him, Mark Mandica. That's MarkMandica.
So I'd say let's get right into our chat with Mark. Hey, Mark, thanks so much for coming on the show. I was wondering if, before we get into any questions or amphibian talk today, could you just introduce yourself to our listeners, tell them who you are and what you do?
Absolutely. My name is Mark Mandica. I am the executive director of the Amphibian Foundation here in Atlanta.
Excellent. Well, thanks for taking time out of your day to come chat with us. I was already familiar with some of what you guys were up to in the Atlanta area through some of your salamander strolls and other educative outreach programs in the Atlanta area. But then I started looking into it more and learning a little bit more about the Amphibian Foundation. I realized this was a really great fit for Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
All right.
Well, actually, can you tell us just a little bit about what you do at the Amphibian Foundation?
Absolutely. The Amphibian Foundation is a nonprofit. We just had our second anniversary. And we focus on novel conservation research plans for endangered species, both here in the Southeast United States and globally. We also have an educational component that we use for several reasons. One is it's our main way to support the foundation through these programs, but we firmly believe that we need to raise the next generation of conservationists, and that's our main target through our outreach program, is getting people excited about amphibians and excited about saving them because they're in a lot of trouble.
And when you say you work on novel conservation solutions, give me an example of what you mean by that. Does that mean like non-standard approaches to?
Yes. So for example, our highest priority research program is on the frosted flatwood salamander, which is significantly imperiled. There's one tiny puddle left in the state of Georgia with this species in it. They're already extinct from South Carolina. Something needs to be done immediately and quickly. So we've developed 20 artificial wetlands where we can monitor them very closely and make sure that these salamanders have everything they need. It's the only captive colony of the species on the planet. So it's really important that we're successful. We've developed these miniature ecosystems, which have never been developed before. So they're brand new. We're very optimistic, but that's what I mean by novel. We had to figure out something that we needed to do immediately because the species is considered at imminent risk of extinction. So it's imperative that we're successful, and we felt like this was our best shot at having them breed successfully in captivity while our partners restore habitat so that we can have some place to release them back into the wild. So that's kind of what I mean by novel.
So with that species in particular, would you say that your main goal is to like build up the populations to where they can get a foothold in their environment, or would it be more of a research focus to like understand what you can do to let them thrive again?
We want to do research, but right now we're really just trying to keep the species alive. We're trying to figure out how to breed them, which has never been done before. So we've been charged with figuring out how to breed them, and once we've cracked that, we are going to basically export this recipe to other institutions with some of our captive-produced offspring so that we can really start generating large numbers of frosted flatwood salamanders every year and have big numbers to release back into restored habitat.
Do you know what has driven them to this point to begin with? Does it have to do with habitats?
Pretty good idea. Yeah. So frosted flatwood salamanders are longleaf pine endemics. So longleaf pine is the coastal plain of Georgia, but that's been reduced to 3% of its historic range. So that whole habitat is almost gone. Obviously, any species that are reliant on that habitat are not doing well. To further that, flatwood salamanders are dependent on wildfire, and that has been suppressed by and large, even in the remaining longleaf pine habitat. Flatwood salamanders need that fire. So if you suppress it, or if you do controlled burns at non-natural times, which is also very common, that really negatively affects the salamander. So we're trying to identify longleaf pine with land managers that are willing to either let wildfires through there or do controlled burns at the natural cycles. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Okay. But I wonder, do you know why they need the fire, what role that plays?
I do. They need open pine savannas, which was very common and is maintained naturally by wildfire every year or two. That's how often that the longleaf pine would burn naturally. So if once you suppress the fire, then the trees obviously start to grow in, they close the canopy, and that's no longer suitable for flatwood salamanders.
Now, this is just part of a larger ongoing mass extinction of amphibians, correct?
Yes.
Is the mass extinction of amphibians, is this something that goes beyond the rate of extinctions in other species? Is this something special, or I mean, how is it linked to the typical habitat loss, climate change based extinctions we're seeing elsewhere?
Right. Excellent question. The animals that I'm familiar with are mostly vertebrates. I'm sure this is also a trend with the invertebrates, but they're all suffering due to habitat loss and shifting climates. But amphibians are so intensely sensitive to the environment. There are more declining amphibians than mammals and birds combined. So they're just disappearing at a profound rate. Right now, if you looked at the IUCN Red List website, they have 43% of the world's amphibians are in catastrophic decline or already extinct.
Wow.
So that's almost half. It's just a huge number. That's why we started the Amphibian Foundation.
Is there a generalizable answer about what makes amphibians particularly vulnerable to these changes in habitats and the climate?
Yes, there have been some identified factors. And then what's and this has been since the 80s, since these causes have been identified, and what's being explored now is how they are working synergistically to be even more expedient at killing amphibians. But their skin, it's really about their skin. So you'll never see a frog drink, for example. They absorb everything through their skin. Anything that we've put into the environment is going to be absorbed up into that amphibian. So there's been lots of research done on pesticides and herbicides and their effects on amphibians that are often sublethal, but they'll grow extra limbs. It will effeminize male frogs. You know, there are lots of estrogen-mimicking compounds that we don't even think about. We just spray it on our lawns, and that will turn amphibians female when they're intended to be male. So that's kind of spooky. And you can see how that would affect the reproductive output for a population.
I've read a lot about I guess I didn't know what the cause was, but general interruptions in the reproductive cycles of amphibians. I think I was reading about maybe the Eastern Hellbender. Is that one that's had reproductive problems?
Yes, and that has other very, very specific problems to the Hellbender. It's one of our favorite amphibians, and it's a Georgia native, so I'm quite fond of it.
Yeah.
But they need pristine streams. I mean, how many pristine streams do you think there are left? You know, very, very few.
Right.
So they have zero tolerance for sedimentation or pollution that you often find in Georgia streams these days.
And are there temperature dynamics in their breeding that come into play as well?
Yes. So that is being investigated now, too, trying to predict the responses of salamanders to climate change. It seems like some are going to be more dependent on others. Hellbenders specifically need very cold water, and that's also going to become a scarcity as things heat up. It's also worth mentioning that the Georgia colloquialism is snot otter for a hellbender. So I always like to say that whenever there's an opportunity.
Well, I've heard, if I'm remembering right, I've heard them sort of vilified by fishermen or something.
Yeah.
Like do they have a pretty good bite?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're the largest North American amphibian, so they get quite large.
So when we're talking about potentially losing so many of these amphibian species, and particularly salamander species, like can you explain the role they play in the larger ecosystem? So we can get a sense, our listeners can get a sense of some of the spiraling, ramifications of losing these species.
So this is a talking point I often give, and I didn't want to miss anything because, honestly, sometimes I'm engaging the public and people are like, who cares if the amphibians are disappearing? But they do a lot of remarkable jobs for us behind the scenes. You know, we don't think about how many there are in the ecosystem because you really have to go out at night in the rain to witness amphibians. But right off the top, my go-to answer is that 1,000 amphibians eat 5 million insects a year, roughly, which is a tremendous number of insects.
Yeah.
And a lot of them specialize in eating mosquitoes. I think that buys them their ticket
certainly to
safety right there, right?
I mean,
so if you think about that alone, that's usually the first thing I say. But there are so many animals that are dependent on them for food. So if you think about it ecologically, you know, tadpoles are vegetarians. They're primary consumers eating vegetable matter. Then they metamorphose into carnivores. So they are turning that sun energy into usable energy that lots of other predators eat. Everything loves to eat. Everything that's a carnivore loves to eat amphibians, either their eggs or their tadpoles or the adults. So they are right in the middle of the food chain and really important to the ecology of any system.
So to back up a little bit, how did you wind up working with amphibians?
I've always loved amphibians. But I grew up in New Jersey and never saw an amphibian growing up. The part of New Jersey where I grew up, probably been 150 years since there's been an amphibian there. It's really developed. But I just always loved frogs. And so my birthdays when I was little, I'd always get rubber frogs and frog PJs. I'm moving all the way up. So I've always had that passion. But when I was an undergrad in an entirely different field, I thought I would take herpetology pass-fail because I was not a science person. And I did, and it just completely changed my life. So I was pretty late in life. I was 30. I'd never heard the term herpetology before, and it blew my mind that you could devote your time to investigating these fascinating animals. And it's really, my life is divided to before I took that class and after. And since then, I've been really focused on amphibians, and I had a lot of great opportunities early on. What really cinched it for me is that I was eager to do field work, and I got an opportunity to do to study two ephemeral, seasonal, temporary wetlands in a remote part of Massachusetts for 2 years. And in Massachusetts, it gets really cold there. So my study started in March, where the ground is still frozen, there's still snow. And I witnessed a salamander migration, a spotted salamander migration over the ice and snow in March, where hundreds of animals were marching over the snow. I was freezing, and these things, they can't even generate their own body heat, but they were just in mass, you know, to so driven to breed, and I just couldn't, it blew my mind, you know, and watching them there, some of the animals were as cold as 19 degrees. And they didn't care. You know, that's pretty amazing. But just hundreds of animals. This is a species that's gorgeous, but they're active for 1 or 2 weeks a year. So your chances of seeing one of these are so slim. Got to see hundreds. And that's really, it's, even to this day, it just carries me because it's such a beautiful species that I got to witness.
That's an amazing image. So as far as them surviving in the cold, I don't know if I'm remembering this right, but I've got a friend who long ago, she worked with salamander research, and she told me about, I think she said that the salamanders they used in research could be frozen solid and then thawed out alive. Is that sometimes the case, or am I misremembering that?
You are not misremembering that. It's pretty well documented, mostly in frogs, freeze tolerance. Mm-hmm. Is being able to freeze and then thaw and really have no negative effect of that. There are several species here in Georgia that can do that. Not salamanders, though, that I'm aware of. A few frogs here in Georgia can freeze. But the salamanders that I was just describing are not freeze tolerant, the spotted salamanders, but they can super cool. So that's being able to go below freezing point and not freeze is a fluid mechanics term called supercooling, super cool. Right? I mean, it's an obvious thing to say about it, but it's really a neat phenomenon as well.
So that's how they could be 19 degrees Fahrenheit and keep moving?
Exactly, because you would think that the water in their body would freeze, but it does not. Now, there's a limit to that, but 19 degrees clearly is not that limit.
Well, I want to hear more about salamanders in general. What's amazing about salamanders? Tell us.
Well, if I haven't convinced anyone yet. One of my favorite things about them, or amphibians in general, is how they feed, how they can move their tongues. When you slow it down with a high-speed video camera, you can really see them do amazing things. You've seen it before. I'm also a science illustrator, and when I was an undergrad, I had the opportunity to illustrate an article on this insane frog that can change the direction of its tongue after it launches it. So
Wow.
Prey is moving. When you slow a frog feeding video down, you usually see them close their eyes before their tongue comes out. So it's like a Hail Mary.
Mm-hmm.
That's a ballistic tongue protraction. There are other frogs and salamanders that have a hydrostatic tongue, control of their hydrostatic tongue. And some of them can pitch it like 180 degrees, you know, and so their tongue can swing out to the – I'm using visual in an audio medium. But it's pretty amazing to watch these animals just whip their tongue out in mid-stroke. So salamanders, what you guys might not know, the fastest tongue known to science is a salamander.
Oh, wow.
And they are named for it. They are the Bulitoglossines, which means bullet tongue. And if you're lucky enough to see regular speed footage of them feeding, you just see things disappear.
Yeah.
That's all you see.
It's instant.
Yeah. And then they can obviously slow that down so you can see what's happening there. The longest tongue is also a salamander, so I'm a nerd, but I find that fascinating because you think about tongue feeding. For a long tongue, you might think of a chameleon or famous for their long tongue and accuracy, but the salamanders have them beat, man. They're just really, really cool.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is because with the chameleons, they seem to get a lot more time in the documentaries. They get a lot more of the like the BBC Planet Earth footage.
You are correct. And they are fascinating in their own right. But you got to give the longest tongue to the salamanders.
You know, often when I think about other animals, I think about what must be the relationship between their brain and central nervous system and the kind of body they have and how they use it. And we just don't have anything like that we can identify with, like that kind of tongue movement, but also the speed of it. I don't know. It's fascinating to imagine what's happening in the animal's brain if it's making a lightning fast flick of the tongue to catch something, but then also maybe angling or moving its tongue after it has been launched in those species that can do that.
Yeah. In some ways, I'm kind of grateful that we don't have to flick our tongue at moving prey. But there probably is not a lot going on. It's just, can I fit that in my mouth? And if so, boom. So that species that I was mentioning with the longest tongue, those tongue muscles and that tongue architecture is anchored to their hips.
Wow.
So that starts at the hips. And that's how they're able to protract it very long. So when you're mentioning those incredible slow motion salamander feeding videos, I think that you're talking about a friend of mine, Steve DeBan, has done that research. So,
That might be it.
Yeah, he gets masterful videos with the high speed camera, and he's the one who has done those anchoring from the hips research studies as well. But I would just say, if it's of interest to any listeners, to look up Steve DeBan's YouTube channel and see those videos because they are so sensational.
All right, we're going to jump in real quick and take a break, but we'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, we're back. Now, some salamander research that I've really enjoyed reading about in the past has concerned the life cycles of salamanders, specifically the tiger salamander. Could you take a moment to tell our listeners a little bit about cannibal morphs?
Now you're really getting into my realm, okay? So cannibal morphs, well, it's fascinating. Plus, it's called cannibal morphs.
Right.
Animals that are obligated to live in a wetland that's going to dry out in 2 or 3 months. There are a lot of animals that will only breed in those types of wetlands, and those are my specialty. They do fascinating things so that to kind of guarantee that they'll be able to get in and out of that wetland and metamorphose in time before it dries out. So there's that clock is ticking. Tiger salamanders have a lot of unique adaptations if the resources are low, if the water is drying out faster than they think they have, or time is running out, they can trigger a cannibal morph where the largest larvae will grow an extra row of teeth in larger masseter or jaw-clawing musculature so that they can start chomping their brothers and sisters. And that's awesome, but they also secrete hormones to prohibit that behavior in any of their cohort. They're the top dog, and they're going to stay the top dog. But if you remove that from the wetland, the next largest one will become cannibal morph.
Wow.
Which is really fascinating. So what you're left with is just one monster tiger salamander.
So what happens when all the cannibalism is done? What happens to that cannibal morph?
As far as I know, it just becomes a very fit adult salamander. Mm-hmm. So it's, I don't know of any research that has compared cannibal morph adults to regular adults, but I imagine that at that point they'd be comparable, meaning that the goal is to just get to metamorphosis safely.
And is the tiger salamander a Georgia salamander?
It is.
Okay.
There are several subspecies, and they're in many states throughout the whole country. But here in Georgia, they've recently been added to the state wildlife action plan. So we're just starting to get concerned about them here in the state.
As far as diversity goes, what is salamander diversity in the state of Georgia like, and how is that compared to other regions of the United States or even the world?
Georgia is an excellent place to become fascinated with salamanders for two main reasons. One is geologically, Georgia is divided into five different ecoregions, And each one of those has different salamander diversity. So you can really witness a lot of different diversity with a very committed day or two-day trip. But as you get to northeastern Georgia, that's where one of the main hotspots for global salamander biodiversity starts. So if you get to Rabun County and go north, you'll start entering one of the hotspots for global salamander diversity, and not only in numbers of species, but just in abundance. So just every log will have multiple salamanders or several species underneath. So it's a great place to carefully go log flipping.
Well, that makes me think, obviously, every region is going to be different and every species is going to be different. But if people want to see cool amphibians in the wild, where are some good places and times for them to look? What should they do to see these animals in the wild? And obviously, we won't encourage messing with them in the wild, but
right.
To see them.
See them, yes, because we all want to leave no trace when we go see these amphibians. My favorites are winter and spring breeders, so I would encourage people to go in the winter and early spring to witness these migrations. That's often a good time, and you can get some clues by our frog friends, okay? So if you're in the U.S., we have some very loud spring frogs. Mm-hmm. We have spring peepers. They're so loud. We have wood frogs. We have chorus frogs. Those are three species that can at least give you a good hint where you might find some salamanders migrating. So that's probably where I would start.
So listen for where it's loudest.
It's just the easiest way, yeah. Mm-hmm. Unless, you know, you can drive very slowly on the roads at night and then you might be able to see some because they are migrating. These are salamanders that have to migrate, and people think of migration as wildebeests or birds or something, but salamanders migrate. They just breed in those wetlands. They don't live in them.
So when I think about frogs making noise, that makes me think about something that's come up with a lot of other species we've talked about, you know, birds and insects like crickets, that part of the habitat that they occupy that we don't often think about is a sonic territory, not just a physical territory. And that, for example, with birds or crickets, noise pollution can really interfere with their way of life. Would the same thing be true for amphibians?
That's an excellent question, and I wish it would. The research that I've read really shows no clear indication. And I think the main reason is that, for the most part, the female frog's ear – so the calls you're hearing are males. Mm-hmm. The advertisement calls of males wooing females. The female ear is tuned to that call, so they don't really hear the calls of other species. So what sounds like a crazy cacophony of different species at a wetland, the female frogs are hearing the calls from their species and don't respond to calls from other species and don't really respond, unfortunately, to noise pollution. Well, I guess it's very fortunate.
No, that is fortunate.
It's extremely fortunate. But I guess when I was saying the context is that this area where the research was conducted was hoping to be able to put some controls on noise pollution. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't interfere with the frogs at all.
My family and I recently went on one of the salamander strolls that the foundation organizes. And I was just really impressed because it was within the city of Atlanta. And granted, Atlanta is a pretty green city compared to many other large urban areas. But, you know, we just went to this area, this little wetland area that's just in the middle of everything. And there were so many salamanders that adults and children alike were able to turn over and examine.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite little places inside of the city. Mm-hmm. And that particular nature preserve, the Clyde Shepherd Nature Preserve, has been particularly committed to removing invasives, plant species. So we've been working with them for a number of years. And if you saw spotted salamanders that day, I can't remember if we saw an adult or not, but we had been restoring that species to that nature preserve for probably the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. But we finally have evidence that they are now reproducing on their own, which is very exciting for the, you know, I told you earlier how much I love that species, mm-hmm. but they would not have been able to persist if the managers didn't remove all those invasive plant species there, because they really challenged the amphibians in ways that they can't, it's no longer suitable for them. Once there's English ivy there, it makes it very, very hard for them.
For what, like chemical reasons or the way it alters terrain? Or
yes, the terrain. So they're salamanders are adorable, but they're not the most coordinated, you know, right. animals. Yeah. So if you make it really challenging, and if you can imagine what a dense mat of English ivy on the ground is like for a little animal that's used to not having English ivy, it can be too much. They were seen there, but not in over 20 years. So we knew that at one time that was a suitable habitat, but then, you know, the English ivy comes in and changes everything for them.
Now, Joe mentioned earlier, you know, we don't want to mess with the salamanders, but if one is observing salamanders in the wild, what are some good rules to employ in interacting with them or viewing them?
Thank you. One common way to encounter them is when they're crossing the road, and that is most undoubtedly them in some type of breeding activity. So you don't want to interfere too much with them. But if you want to encourage them or help them cross the road, that is not shunned, because the chances of them successfully encountering a car are slim. You know, so we always move them in the direction that they're heading. If you put them in the way they were coming from, then they're going to have to cross the road again. I always make sure that I don't have any salts on my hands or rinse my hands off. And that's a pretty safe way to be safe around salamanders, is if you're unless you've got the gear and gloves and everything, because there are so many problems for amphibians now that we at the Amphibian Foundation and other amphibian conservationists and biologists, we have to take many more precautions than just rinsing the salts off our hands. We have to disinfect in between every wetland all of our gear because of emergent infectious disease, which is becoming more and more prevalent and is wiping out salamanders globally. But that's not something that the average person has to be concerned with, making sure, because we always have salt on our hands. So rinse your hands. If you're going to handle a salamander, be very gentle and don't move it too far, because these things have home ranges that they've honed their whole lives. So another fascinating thing about salamanders for me is that about 90% of many species of salamanders return to that same little puddle they were born in. So they have a really significant site fidelity, where they metamorphose in a tiny ephemeral wetland. 90% of the animals will return there for the rest of their lives to breed. So it's very important that those wetlands stay intact. You know, if that wetland is paved or if a road is put in between the wetland and their upland habitat, then they're just going to cross it, you know. So it's something that not a lot of people think about.
And when you say they return to a puddle, you mean literally a puddle?
That's my term for an ephemeral wetland, because some of them are as small as a dining room table, you know, and that is a suitable wetland for these salamanders. Some of them are significantly larger than that, but if they dry out after a few months every year, to me, it's just a big puddle. They're often just a foot or two deep. You know, they don't really get very deep. And so, yeah.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
You mentioned a minute ago infectious diseases affecting amphibians. What kind of major disease threats are amphibians facing today?
There are many. Some of them have been documented for longer periods of time. When I started in the 90s, I was monitoring a population of wood frogs, another Massachusetts native that does get down into Georgia, but one day, all the tadpoles were dead. So if you can imagine, you know, they were fine the day before, and then the next day they were dead. That was a rhinovirus. It's now it's a very well-known virus that can be transmitted by us. You know, you can get it on your boots and track it from one wetland to the next. And then it's a novel to that the species in there. They haven't encountered it before. They have no resistance. They die. Wow. So more recently, in the 2000s, there was a more identifying fungal infection. Chytrid fungus is the most well-known lethal infection. Probably it's recently been described as of Asian origin. Asian amphibians have it, and it doesn't bother them. You know, they've evolved with it. But when we inadvertently move it from one place to another, those amphibians have never seen it before, and it's lethal. So it's has the potential and has killed amphibians in pristine environments, you know, where you would think that the amphibians would be doing quite well. Panama, for example, remote Panama, where 85% of the amphibians have been wiped out from chytrid fungus. So
wow.
It's devastating. More recently, there's a new strain of chytrid fungus that affects salamanders specifically. It's nicknamed B-Sal. The name is actually much longer. It's another chytrid fungus, and it can kill 100% of the salamanders it affects. It's been moved from Asia to Europe, where it's wiping out fire salamanders, which is a beautiful and very famous type of salamander. And if a salamander gets infected with that fungus, it will die.
What does the infection look like? How does it attack it?
The first chytrid I was telling you about, you cannot see it. So an amphibian will look fine, but it's not fine. And it basically prohibits gas exchange across the skin. The frog will suffocate. Oh. B-sal is visible with lesions on the skin, so you can see, but it's still it's affecting the skin of the animal. The fungus feeds on the skin, changes the dynamics of the skin.
Yet again, the skin seems like mm-hmm. it's...
That's where they get it, because they're yeah. so sensitive. That's why we rinse our hands before we touch them, because the salt is, they're so sensitive to it.
I would have to guess, though, that with the evolutionary trade-offs, with all these vulnerabilities about their skin, there must be amazing things about their skin as well.
Like yeah.
There must be good reasons for them to have skin like that.
Yeah, you are correct. And, you know, they do a fair amount of their respiration right through their skin. So, and there are a whole bunch of salamanders right here in Georgia that don't even have lungs. They just do all of their respiration through their skin. Just bypass that whole lung thing. So I've seen them, even those salamanders, just be underwater. They're able to exchange the gas right through their skin. So I'm not sure how much of an advantage that is, but they can get by without lungs, which is pretty neat. You know, they just seem very, very sensitive and are always tied to the water.
So you mentioned earlier there was a role of amphibians in control of insect populations, specifically mosquito populations. Do you want to say any more about the role of amphibians in, say, preventing the spread of mosquito-borne disease and other diseases?
Absolutely. So what we were talking about earlier was a direct relationship where the salamander larvae are consuming mosquitoes, so or mosquito larvae controlling them directly like that. But there's more and mounting evidence about tadpoles, which, you know, are vegetarians, but they are competing with mosquito larvae, and they're making wetlands less suitable for mosquito larvae. So a healthy wetland with a healthy amphibian population is less suitable for mosquitoes, less mosquito numbers, less chances of mosquito-borne diseases. So, and there's even some more evidence that it's just not suitable at all for mosquitoes with a real healthy population of tadpoles. So you'd think of tadpoles as pretty innocuous, but there's also more evidence about what happens to a wetland when the tadpoles are removed. So in these populations where chytrid fungus, for example, is wiping out the tadpoles, these streams are becoming choked and clogged with algae that would normally be controlled, and then it gets more stagnant, and you can imagine there are more mosquitoes.
Do you think generally amphibians and mosquitoes are sort of looking for the same kind of thing when they're choosing wetland environments to breed in?
Perhaps in the larval stage is possible, yeah.
All right, time to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with more of our talk with Mark Mandica. And we're back. So earlier we were talking about the cannibal morphs, but you mentioned that there are other ways that the breeding in ephemeral wetlands produces amazing results in phenotypic expression in the amphibian. So what are these other ways?
Well, thank you. Darwin, he theorized that animals that were exposed to the same dynamic systems repeatedly would to be able to shift their phenotype between these things depending on what it was ecologically called for. So, for example, these ephemeral wetlands, which are so dynamic that can dry out and flood and freeze solid, the animals have developed phenotypic plasticity where they, out of necessity, have to be able to fluctuate. The cannibal morph is an extreme example, but also many species, when they detect a predator in the wetland with them, dragonfly larvae, something that likes to eat tadpoles, they can just grow bigger tails. They can swim faster because once they've detected prey, and I find that fascinating too. And there are toads, spadefoot toads, which are vegetarian but can turn cannibal morph. So that's even more outrageous, right? I mean, it's like insane because they have these little scraper beaks to eat algae but then can grow teeth and jaw muscles and stuff.
This is okay. Like they have a built-in contingency to change what kind of animal they are depending on their environment.
Yeah. And I find that fascinating, you know, because it's all just about getting out of that wetland in time. There are other species which have evolved temporally to breed slightly off or slightly ahead of the majority of amphibians so that their larvae are just a little bit bigger. So when everyone else comes to the pond, they can just start eating them. And I just find that fascinating too. That's our marbled salamander, and that's another native Metro Atlanta species that we've detected through our surveys here. And they're beautiful. I would encourage anyone to Google marbled salamander because they're so beautiful.
Now, when we talk to people who are obsessed with certain kinds of animals, we often end up asking them, do you have a favorite prehistoric example? Do you have a favorite prehistoric amphibian?
Yes.
Yeah, that you wish was still around, or maybe we shouldn't wish was still around?
No, I think we'd be all right.
Okay. Tell us.
Well, you know, I also love to talk about how there were frogs and salamanders hopping and crawling at the feet of the dinosaurs. So they were here before the dinosaurs, and some of them ate the dinosaurs. So just think about that Beazel Bufo. Not sure if that's my favorite, but just because it translates into devil toad, used to eat baby dinosaurs.
Oh, wow.
That's just really awesome. But
that was a really big one, wasn't it?
It was a big frog, but it resembled an extant frog, the horned frog. So they look they looked very similar to a frog we still have today, just much larger.
Do you know how big?
I think they were only maybe a foot or a foot and a half tall.
That's so pretty big for a frog.
Yeah. Yeah. But we have these other amphibians from an extinct lineage. There's Diplocallis, which you've ever seen as a boomerang head.
Oh, yes,
they're
yes.
Really, really cool looking, you know. And then there's Eriops, which was more like a crocodilian ecologically. So it would hang in the shallows and just ambush prey and was about – the cross between a salamander and a pit bull, maybe, because they're 6 feet long and highly aggressive with massive skulls that could inflict a very serious bite.
Wow.
I love prehistoric amphibians. So,
yeah. So you mentioned, was it Diplocallis?
Diplocallis.
With the boomerang. Do we know what that structure was for, or is that a mystery?
It is a mystery, but I think what I've read theorized was that it was a hydrodynamic property. So it was a fully aquatic amphibian. So it used it to navigate the water.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty impressive, though.
Yeah.
Because it was skeletal. It's the skull is a big boomerang.
Well, so you mentioned this giant prehistoric salamander with the big skull and the big bite. I think I've heard that. Well, we mentioned the hellbenders earlier. Like salamanders some of them can give a good bite, right?
Yes. Usually for a human, it means nothing, though. But like tiger salamanders, we've mentioned several times now because they're awesome. They're highly aggressive. So we have a pet salamander, my little boy does, and he wiggles his finger right in front of its mouth and it just jumps up and latches on.
But it's not painful.
Doesn't hurt at all. Don't have much bite force. But then there are other salamanders. There's a native Amphiuma, which is an aquatic coastal plain species, which I've been bitten by, and it hurts.
Yeah.
A lot. Yeah. Very, very strong bite. So I guess it just depends on what species you're talking about.
What kind of prey animal would that bite be for?
I've seen them take small mammals. I've seen take a fish. So I think that they're just meant to not – like they won't let go. Whatever they bite is going to stay in their mouth. So terrifying.
It does sound more and more like with the salamanders, and I guess the amphibians in general, when we see them, say, at zoos or other or as pets, we see them in the tank and they're very stationary. They're not moving much. It's easy to just think of them as this – stationary species that's not active or aggressive.
Yeah. And you're not wrong. You're probably you're probably acknowledging 90%+ of what they do.
Right.
But it's that other portion, you know. So you know, we're learning now that salamanders, even though they're active for 1 to 2 weeks a year, mm-hmm. they can be very active during that time, and they can travel large distances. You know, for a salamander, up to 5 football fields in length, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, that's for something that's as tiny and clumsy as a salamander. That's quite a distance, and frogs can easily travel 3 times that amount. You know, so. It might also be worth mentioning that there is a third group of amphibians that we just haven't mentioned yet today, so it'd be worth mentioning the Sicilians, which is the third type of amphibian. There's frogs and toads, salamanders and newts, and then these limbless burrowing Sicilians, which are largely a mystery because they live underground. They come up when it floods. You don't see them. They're pantropical. They're on basically every continent as long as it's warm enough, and they're fascinating, you know, but they and they also bite very hard, but it's only a problem if you're a worm or some other type of prey. But I like to mention them whenever possible, because a few years ago the 200th species of Sicilian was discovered. That's kind of a big deal for the amphibian nerds. Now I think there are as many as 207, so it's really climbing up there. But it's a really interesting group of amphibians that we like to teach the kids about, and we cover in our biology classes as well.
Yeah, subterranean vertebrates in general, seems like there's a lot of outstanding questions and new things to learn about them. There's always weird new stuff about, like, the naked mole rat and all that.
Yeah.
So I got to give these things a look up.
Look them up. So it's not spelt like someone from Sicily, though.
Okay.
It's C-A-E-C-I-L-I-A-N, Sicilian.
All right. I'm ashamed I didn't know.
Oh, well, I can talk about them more if you'd like, but they come in really bright colors as well. Some of them are solid, bright, bright yellow.
Oh, wow.
They live underground. Why are they bright yellow?
Yeah, that's a good question.
There's other ones with blue with white rings all the way around them.
Wow.
And then a recent paper came out last year, Siphonops is the genus. This Sicilian can secrete mucus from its face to lube up the ground so it can basically swim in the dirt.
Wow.
While excreting toxin at the tail end so nothing can follow it.
Wow.
That is badass. Right? Did I say badass? Because that is.
Yo, certainly.
Yeah, that's that fine. Is just amazing, right? It's just mind-blowingly cool.
Well, this gets back to something we always touch on the show, is that, you know, you think of, you know, fictional monsters, you know, from comic books or films or books. And no matter how creative we think we've been in creating some sort of exotic creature, it's almost always matched or exceeded by the natural world. And the salamanders and amphibians in general seem to be prime examples of this.
Yeah. And they're I like to refer to them as the slimy underdogs. You know, they're just very poorly understood. Not often considered, no resentment here. But when you talk about animal conservation, you usually see a picture of a panda, and they are very cute. But, you know, there's a whole world out there that needs our attention, and that's why we have the Amphibian Foundation.
Well, speaking of which, you know, at this point in the episode, hopefully, you know, people who didn't really understand what amphibians were all about and why they were important and why they were amazing, they have a different view now, and people who are already on board are just more excited. But if people out there want to help protect salamanders and other amphibians, what can they do? What should they be doing? And I realize you have local expertise, and there are global answers to this as well. So perhaps if you could start globally and then maybe speak to our more local listeners as well.
Absolutely. And there are lots of things that people can do if they're interested. At this point, there are many community science programs. It depends on how much time you have. But if you would like to monitor amphibians in your area, generally speaking, monitoring programs or frog call surveys, and they're always looking for people to participate in those surveys. There are regional programs that exist worldwide, you know, and there are global networks. The Amphibian Survival Alliance comes to mind. Amphibian ARC is another partner of ours that is a global network that are about putting species who need attention and connecting them with people who would like to provide that attention. So that those would be the first steps I would take. And then we have a growing list of resources on our blog for how to make your property more amphibian friendly, you know, and that's it's been a delight to put this together and also having people interested in those types of things because, you know, they generally involve doing less yard work. You know, you want to do less. You want to let it go a little bit, at least
finally
let it get rough around the edges. You know?
Finally an excuse.
Yeah. Leaf litter is gold to an amphibian. You know, if you're getting rid of your leaves, then it's a lot less suitable for them. So you can use that as an excuse to leave your leaves in place. Often amphibian conservation programs are significantly underfunded too. So I would mention that as something that if you have resources for contributing to amphibian conservation in that way, contact your local amphibian conservation programs and I'm sure that they'll be in need of funding. And those are the main ones that I can think of. Yeah.
And you mentioned the blog. Can you share the web address with everyone?
Yes. To get to the resources for making your yard more amphibian friendly or even constructing an amphibian pond, that has been in such high demand that we created a direct link, which is backyard.frogsneedourhelp.org.
And then the Amphibian Foundation itself, the website is
amphibianfoundation.org.
Now, as we come to a close here, we understand you have a music background, that you are a musician. And correct me if I'm wrong. I might be – this is like secondhand information. But did you tour China in an American funk band?
Why, yes, I did.
Please tell us about that.
Sure. I was fortunate enough to play in the very first American rock band to play in China. So
oh,
that's
wow.
kind of a big deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That was in 1987.
Oh, wow.
And it was part of a cultural exchange program that went kind of bonkers because the way I understood it was the year before the guitar was legalized in China. So they were just starting to open up to mm-hmm. certain things. We wanted to come over there with our instruments. And basically what happened was a 5-city tour for the whole summer. So I was pretty young. And was basically treated like the Beatles once we got there because they had never seen an American rock band before. It was one of the greatest experiences of my life, and it was very, very warm reception. We were the Misguided Youth, so that was our name, and it was really, really wonderful. Yeah, it was great. Thanks for asking. I should mention that my contemporary music is all very salamander related, not conceptually musically, but I go under the name Mud Puppy, which is one mm-hmm. of my favorite Neotenic salamanders. And yeah, so that's that.
Now, is it more rock and roll, more funk? Like, what is your sound?
Funk.
Funk,
yeah.
Okay.
It's funk, and I guess at this point it always will be. We have a recording studio, which is Neotenic Studios, which is another very salamander nerd name, which means the retention of juvenile characteristics into adulthood, which seems to fit me well. Yeah.
So speaking of funk, speaking of amphibians, what is the most funk amphibian? Which is the funkiest of the amphibians?
If I had to say, I would go with this crazy frog that I've only seen on nature documentaries, the hairy frog.
Oh.
So it's a hairy frog, so that's cool and a little bit gross, right? Because it has
literally hairy.
Well, it can't be literal hair, but it looks like hair.
Okay.
But it's really these long tubercles that look like hair. And what makes them even crazier is that as a defense, they can break their own fingers, and they do often break their own fingers to make the tips really sharp.
Oh.
And then those sharpened bones come out of their skin and they can use that as an attack.
Now that you're saying this, Robert, have you written about these frogs before?
I think I did. Coming back to the monster thing, it was I think the comparison was stuff like Wolverine. You know, you look at Wolverine and you think, oh, that's so inventive, that's so cool. But nature came up with that
in a frog
ages ago.
Yep. So that's exactly right. All right. So I'm glad that you guys have been exploring them a little bit on your own too, because that is pretty funky.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Awesome. Yeah. Delighted to be here today. Thank you.
All right. So there you have it. Thanks again to Mark Bandica for coming on the show here, actually being here in the studio with us to discuss amphibians and especially the salamanders.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. We really appreciate him joining us. And we hope all of you will take something away from today's episode. Maybe get involved a little bit with amphibians in your area, because it sounds like there's a lot to do.
That's right. And hey, if you want to know more about the Amphibian Foundation, or you want to support the Amphibian Foundation, again, that's amphibianfoundation.org. On Twitter and Facebook is Amphibian Found, and on Instagram as Amphibian Foundation. And you can also just look around and find out what your more localized amphibian group happens to be and support them. And if you want to follow us, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the episodes of the podcast, links out to our various social media accounts, a tab for our store. That's a great way to support the show, by buying cool merchandise with our logo on it. And if you want to support the show in other ways, just simply rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so.
Big thanks, as always, to our audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly with feedback about this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for a future episode, or just to say hi, send some greetings, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
In this episode, Mark talked a little bit about his music, and so we're closing out the episode here with a track that Mark provided us with. It is called Stick in the Mud, Refunked.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL Schedule Release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule-release to learn more.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.